So
we have some time to reflect together on one of my favorite Torah readings, Parsha Balak. And this week's Torah reading, Balak, invites us to reflect on who or what is driving our behavior. What master are we serving? So often, we're unaware of the forces that drive so many of our behaviors. From modern neuroscience, we know that most of what we have learned and what we know and much of what drives our behavior is not articulated in conscious thought. But the ancients seemed to know this from the beginning of storytelling time. They seemed to understand that humans were not behaving rationally and that other forces were needed to explain human behavior. The ancients invoked gods and spirits and other forces that we might call magical or mystical. Yet they were onto something, onto the idea that so much of human behavior cannot be understood as the product of rational, intentional decision making. Whether the mysterious, unknowable origin of so many of our behaviors is identified in neuroscience, in some brain circuitry outside the realm of conscious awareness, or whether it's attributed in ancient traditions to gods and spirit forces, even today we can be drawn to be explorers in this frontier of awareness. Different psychological approaches, such as psychoanalysis, dream interpretation, and other approaches, encourage an attitude of non-judgmental openness to all the products of the mind with the intent of interpreting and understanding human behavior according to one or another particular framework. In contrast, during meditation, we are simply being with the mind, with whatever arises. We're not stopping intentionally to explore. We're being with the mind without trying to interpret. We're encouraged, and explicitly in the Zen tradition, to think not thinking, to bring awareness to each perception, sensation, experience without trying to interpret it or think about it. And then, when we find ourselves doing that, to return to the breath, to the awareness practice, without judgment, and just noticing any reaction that we have to having wandered from our task. In my own practice, I've been surprised to discover what thoughts and images come up when I meditate. I sometimes refer to this as seeing what my mind is doing when I'm not looking. It's as if suddenly in meditation, my awareness has caught my mind in the act of secretly generating some irrational reaction behind my back, so to speak. Now, unlike psychotherapy, the intention in meditation is not to correct a misinterpretation or to fix anything in the mind. So what good is meditation? It's hard to say. However, since most of what we learn and much of what drives our behavior has been acquired without our conscious awareness, I have a vague sense that I am giving space and care and loving attention to all aspects of my mind when I meditate, and that this is a helpful and self-regulating process. And Thich Nhat Hanh uses a phrase like, hold your anger like a baby, that our awareness is giving that maternal compassion and soothing quality of attention to whatever is going on in the mind, whether we're aware of it in articulating thoughts or not. So what does this have to do with the story of Balaam and Balak? At the end of last week's Torah reading, The Israelites have occupied the land of the Amorites, and they're poised to occupy the land of the Moabites. So the terror that the Israelite spies felt in Parshah Shelach Lecha that Reggie talked about a few weeks ago, that feeling of seeing themselves as grasshoppers in a land of giants, that imagery is now reversed, and the terror is in the heart of Balak, the king of Moab. He says to his elders, "Now this horde will lick clean all that is about us as an ox licks up the grass of the field." In a state of panic, he sends messengers to Balaam, the prophet, the seer, this person who has credentials in giving powerful curses. He says to his messengers, "Tell Balaam, there is a people that came out of Egypt. It hides the earth from view, and it settled next to me. Come then, put a curse on this people for me, since they are too numerous for me, for perhaps I can thus defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed indeed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So King Balak's behavior, his behavior is driven by fear, a fear of being conquered, killed, a fear of losing his power, a fear of humiliation. Of course, from the perspective of the invaded people, it seems only natural that Balak wants to defend his land from this invading people that he perceives as a horde. But our Jewish commentators point out that Balak is not just driven by the wish to protect his people so that they can live in peace, undisturbed by this horde that he feels. He's not simply asking, he doesn't ask Balak to bless his own people and protect his own people. He wants Balak, the best curse maker, he wants Balaam, the prophet, who's the best curse maker that money can buy. He wants Balaam to curse the invaders. And what motivates Balaam, the prophet, who's known for being skilled at these curses? Depending on how we're inclined to feel about Balaam, we can understand his motivations in different ways, as our different commentators do. And the very surface of the story is itself confusing, without even delving below the surface. And of course, this reflects life, in which it's often hard to read the signals and decide what's the right thing to do. When first approached by the king's messengers, Balaam tells them, "Spend the night here, and I shall reply to you as the Lord may instruct me." And that night, God came to Balaam, perhaps in a dream, but God gave Balaam a clear message. "Do not go with those men. You must not curse those people, for they are blessed." So I'm fascinated by this turn of the story. God seems to speak directly and clearly to Balaam, as he does with Moses, as he did with Abraham. And he does this in a way that gives credibility to Balaam's role as a mystic, a seer. If Balaam's curses were of no significance, either in their ability to do powerful things or in the impact they have on others, why would God make a point of visiting Balaam and forbidding Balaam to make a curse? So Balaam listens to God and tells King Balak's dignitaries, "Go back to your country, for the Lord will not let me go with you." So King Balak sends more numerous and more distinguished dignitaries to offer Balaam more rewards, to see if perhaps by raising the stature of the dignitaries and the amount of wealth, King Balak can convince this prophet to do his bidding. So what controls Balaam's behavior? Balaam again says he can only do God's will, but this night God came to Balaam and said to him, "If these men have come to invite you, you may go with them, but whatever I command you, you shall do." So in the morning, Balaam takes this message at face value and saddles his ass and departs with the Moabite dignitaries. But God was incensed at his going. Now we can't help but ask, you know, why did God say Balaam could go and then get incensed at him for going? Is God acting like some impetulant person who hopes will read their mind and intuit what they want, like the person who says, "Oh no, don't go out of your way to help me make dinner," and then later is enraged and resentful about not getting any help? That's like, you know, like that person wanted you to just know the right thing to do. Or is God angry at being asked twice, as parents get angry at children who just ask over and over and over, hoping that the next time they'll get what they want? Because Balaam's driven by some greed for wealth and fame and fortune? Or is this part of the narrative simply representing the way things are, that it's hard to figure out the right thing to do, and we get mixed messages from reality? But God does give one clear message: whatever I command you, you must do. But that depends on Balaam having the ability to perceive what is being commanded moment to moment. Just like we start out with a plan and then the context changes and we have to respond to what is required in each moment anew. So despite his reputation as a seer, in this lovely, ironic, and slapstick part of the narrative, Balaam, the seer, does not see the angel of God standing and blocking the way. Only his ass, on whom he's riding, can perceive the presence of the angel of the Lord, who stands in the path with his sword drawn. The ass, seeing the angel, swerves from the road into the fields, and Balaam beat the ass to turn her back onto the road. But the angel blocks the path, and the ass swerves again, this time pressing Balaam's foot into the wall, so he beat her again. And finally, with the angel still blocking the way, the ass lays down. And Balaam was furious and beat the ass a third time with his stick. And then the Lord opened the ass's mouth, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have beaten me these three times?" And Balaam, evidently more worried about how he looks to these dignitaries, how he's feeling humiliated by his dumb animal, he's more embarrassed than he is curious to understand what the problem is. Balaam responds, "You have made a mockery of me. If I had a sword with me, I'd kill you." And the ass calmly responds with a grace and composure that is rarely seen in conflictual interactions among the Torah characters. The ass says, "Look, I am the ass that you have been riding all along until this day. Have I been in the habit of doing thus to you?" And Balaam has to admit, no. And with that, the Lord uncovered Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his sword drawn in his hand. So Balaam bowed down and said he would turn back. But again, the messenger of the Lord says, "Go with the men, but you must say nothing except what I tell you." Now, this interaction between the renowned prophet and the ass has been interpreted as a commentary on the importance of paying attention to the wisdom of the body, as the mind can be so easily distracted and deluded by imagining, for example, riches that will be rewarded for this mission. The mind can delude us and make us mistrust or even ignore what what is right before our very eyes. We can be so preoccupied with our thoughts, our goals, our plans and fantasies, how we look to other people, that we lose touch with our very senses. Balaam's ass gives him an opportunity to come to his senses, to return to seeing what is in front of him, rather than focusing on his preoccupation with his reputation or desire for reward. And ultimately, Balaam offers three blessings for the Israelites rather than three curses, speaking the words that God puts in his mouth, allowing himself to be a channel for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's blessing. So Balaam, seeing that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, did not, as on previous occasions, go in search of omens, but turned his face to the wilderness. As Balaam looked up and saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, the Spirit of God came upon him, and he uttered the well-known blessing, Ma Tovu, the words of our morning prayer, How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling, O Israel. Perhaps there have been moments when you have turned toward the wilderness, or just toward the sunset, or seeing a heron lifting off from the water, or seeing children laughing and playing, and suddenly you feel yourself bursting into spontaneous praise. In a moment of clear seeing, we can be taken with the beauty of some aspect of our world, but it's hard to be available to see that beauty and to feel that spontaneous praise when we're preoccupied with the mission we have to accomplish, with the worry about what we look like to others, with the need for acquiring fame and fortune. We need to attend to the messages from our body, to be curious, rather than enraged when the body, like the ass in the story, begins to act differently after carrying us along for, these many years. We often refer to the wisdom of the body without really appreciating how much our bodies take care of without our having to run the show, without our conscious minds. Hearts pumping, gastric juices flowing, all without having to give instruction. The breath is unique in being both automatic and also under our voluntary control. If we don't pay attention, the body will breathe on its own. But if we want to, we can speed up or slow down our breathing voluntarily. And because of this unique combination of voluntary and involuntary control, the breath is a favorite focus for meditation, a doorway between the consciously controlled functions of our body and the functions that the body handles on its own outside of our awareness. I recall hearing Norman Fisher say that we may have lots of thoughts and worries about dying, but we don't need to worry about dying because our bodies know how to die. Somehow, this was very reassuring to me. And similarly, when I worry about how I meditate, and when I feel I have no clue how to meditate, I realize I don't have to worry because the body knows how to be still. The body, if arranged in a comfortable but stable posture, knows how to be relatively still and how to breathe. So if we abstain from voluntary movement and tune into the sensations of the breathing body, our bodies will teach us how to meditate, how to be present in each moment. For our bodies have no choice but to be present in each moment, while our minds can fly off anywhere in an instant.